Mormon Stories Podcast takes a ton of work and depends solely upon listener support. To keep this program alive, please consider a donation today at mormonstories.org. Hello and welcome to another edition of Mormon Stories Podcast. I am your host, John DeLynn, and I'm very happy to have you with us today. And today we have with us a very special guest that I'm very excited to have. Her name is Natasha Parker. Natasha, welcome to Mormon Stories.
Hi, John.
Now, Natasha, you might be known to some of my listeners as the founder and chief blogger at the blog Mormon Therapist. Is that right?
That's right.
And tell us your blog address real quick.
It's mormontherapist.blogspot.com.
That's right. And Natasha, you've been blogging for quite some time. How much time have you been blogging?
I believe over 2 years.
Yeah, a couple years.
Yes.
And I've pretty much been following you ever since you came out with your blog. And
that's cool.
Yeah, yeah. And you do great work. So
thank you.
And also, you blog for Mormon Matters, is that right?
Yes, I do a weekly article for them.
MormonMatters.org, and I've really enjoyed your post there as well. And I have to admit that I really enjoyed your episode. You did one episode with Mormon Expression, right?
That's right.
Yeah, and that was fantastic. So
yeah, just a few months ago.
Yep. So I just... Let me go ahead and set up for our listeners a little bit of context, okay. If that's okay. I've mentioned to my listeners for some time that I'm pursuing a PhD in clinical psychology, and I'm very interested in mental health generally, and specifically mental health within Mormonism and within the LDS Church and within its broader culture. So I stated as a primary goal for 2010 to begin an exploration of mental health and Mormonism, but I thought, you know, since I'm only a year into my graduate work, that I didn't want to do it alone and could probably be a lot more effective to partner with somebody. So Natasha, you're the first person I really approached about it because you're the first person I thought of as being a fantastic partner. So,
well, thank you.
Yeah. So. You're welcome. So I guess I'll just tell my listeners that what I hope to do is begin sort of a bit of a collaboration with Natasha to have her come on and with some regularity, let's say once a month or even more frequently, depending on how things go and how much Natasha likes it, have Natasha, you know, produce at least one episode a month, if not more, surrounding various topics around mental health and Mormonism. And so that's the idea. And I thought that the best way to sort of kick that off would be to bring you on and learn a little bit about your story and just to talk about mental health generally within Mormonism. How does that sound?
That sounds great.
Good. So with that, I would like to begin and just have you tell us a little bit about your background. You know, who
okay.
you are, maybe a little bit about what got you into therapy. Start there.
Okay. Well, I started out at BYU as a business major, believe it or not, and decided I really didn't like that. Was not a numbers girl, even though I'm quite analytical. I didn't do well with numbers. So then I was kind of lost, you know, and just not sure what to do next. But I did take a Psych 101 class just kind of as an elective and just fell in love with it. And I don't remember the name of the professor. She was actually non-LDS and quite young. She had just gotten her PhD and I think this was her first teaching assignment and just a fascinating woman. She was married to a member who also taught at BYU, I think in the English department, if I remember. And I wish I could remember her name. She was very influential, I believe, in my career choice and just was, you know, very open about many different aspects of mental health. I also took a women's studies class from her later on. She did not have a great experience at BYU, I think, because she was not LDS. and would often speak to us in her classes about some of the experiences that she was having, which really surprised me, of course, because I thought we were all wonderful Mormons.
Right.
And some of the experiences that she had that were really quite discriminatory were quite shocking to me, both from faculty and students. So that, you know, started me thinking a lot about Mormonism and, of course, how we respond to things, especially when things are different from us, and why this woman that I thought was fantastic was having such a difficult time. And I do not believe they stayed on for many years after that. I think they moved away as a couple and taught at some other university.
That's too bad.
If I remember correctly. But anyway, that started my journey with psychology. And then I graduated from BYU. And
with a bachelor's in psychology.
With a bachelor's in psychology. Okay. And, you know, got married about a year later and moved to Wichita, Kansas. And so kind of decided to look around at what happened there. I knew I wanted to get my master's degree. I knew I wanted to do therapy work, and I knew I couldn't do that without at least a master's degree. And they had several programs there, one in clinical psychology and I forget one other one, but one in marriage and family therapy. And I had never really heard about that profession as in kind of as a specialty of its own before. And was very intrigued and just was ended up being a perfect fit for me. Loved it. And it was interesting when we went in there, I think the first class, you know, the very first thing they said is, you know, you just want to be very aware of why you're in here and why you're becoming a therapist. So I've been thinking about that ever since. And that most of us, you know, that go into therapy work have, you know, our own issues with our own families or our own friends and our own lives. And we're interested in figuring those things out. And that's what kind of leads us to the profession. So I very much appreciated, I guess, a lot of self-therapy through that program.
Sure. Let me ask you a quick question. And this is going to seem out of left field a little bit, but, you know, I guess within the church, there sometimes are these traditional gender roles and the husband works and the mom stays home. And I know in the 21st century, for many people, that's just not the reality, and there's lots of dual-income families. But let's just assume that there's some, you know, traditional LDS church members who have traditional beliefs about gender roles. How did you decide that having a bit of a career was right for you, and how did you muster the strength or the courage or the determination or whatever it is to break out of that traditional gender role from being a mommy and having a job on the side? Is that just something that came from you, from your parents, or just came from inside you, or what?
Well, that's a really good question. And gosh, I could talk about that for 3 hours in of itself. I'll be very honest. It's been something I've struggled with all along, and have had very different thoughts about that all along. Even now, I struggle with that issue. My family is highly educated. My mom has a PhD. They're very much into education. So that was never a struggle to go get my education. That was just an expectation. I think that where I started to struggle was how much would I be working and when to start a family. So I'll be very upfront that we waited. My husband and I waited quite a while to have kids. I mean, we got married and we had our first child 4 years later. And I struggle with the many differing messages that the church gives. One message is start a family right away. Uh-huh. Another message is be self-sufficient. Uh-huh. And for me, the self-sufficient won out.
Right.
I was always, for one reason or another, concerned that, you know, what if something happens to my husband? What if we get divorced? What if he dies? What in the heck am I going to do?
Yeah.
And so I was not comfortable having children without having some type of backup plan that I could fall back on myself. And so that was a big part of it.
Gotcha.
And I also thought too that, you know, in order to be a good mom, part of that is to be well-rounded and have a lot of different things that I can offer to my kids. And part of that is an education. Now, since having children, I have worked, but I have worked very part-time, you
right.
know, like three to 4 or 5 hours a week even. I'm working a little bit more now that my kids are school age, but So that's something that I've continued to struggle with. Another aspect that was unique to my profession is that my master's degree was 2 years, but I also needed, after that, 2 years of full-time work to get any license in any state in the United States. And so I knew I did not want to work full-time at that point and have children. So I chose to get that licensure stuff out of the way before we started our family. I've never regretted that decision, and I'm very happy, and I don't think it's affected the number of children we've had or anything like that. So, you know, those are decisions that everybody has to make, and sure, they're very personal decisions.
Right. Well, I just wanted to explore that a bit because I know there are some listeners who will have to be making those same type of decisions soon. So,
yeah, and it's hard because I think it's hard not to feel judged or to not judge others that are not doing it our way, you know, or the way that we think is right. And I think there are many different ways of doing it right. And that's up to each couple.
And before we jump back into your actual schooling or wherever else you want to take the story, you were able to do your practice part-time. Is that right?
Yes. After I had my license. Now, right. I would not have been able to do that if I didn't have my license.
But now that you're licensed, you can do mom part-time and work part-time, and that works out quite well.
Yeah, well, the mom is never part-time.
That's awesome. Absolutely.
That's full-time all the way.
So you have a second shift is what they call it in the academic world.
That's right.
Okay, well, go ahead and continue. I'm sorry I took you on that diversion.
No, that's fine. I'm trying to. Well, so then I went to Friends University in Wichita, Kansas, and got my master's degree there.
Okay.
And then I got, well, then we moved again because my husband wanted to go back to school. And so we moved to Ann Arbor, Michigan. And there I got my 2 years of, like I said, that 2 years that I needed to work full time. I did it in an addictions treatment center in Detroit. So that that was fascinating.
For 2 years?
Yes.
So you've done a lot of addiction work.
Yes.
That's great.
Okay. I'm not an addictions counselor, though. Some of that has changed now, where addiction counseling, you need to have a license specifically in that. So I'm not actually an addictions counselor, but I have worked a lot in addictions.
No, and I imagine that some of that training applies elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think the most unique thing about my training that I love is that it was very systems oriented. It was very family centered. And that, in a sense, went right along with all of my gospel doctrine and values. And, you know, it wasn't, you know, when you see even an individual, I was trained to see that individual in the context of their family and of their system that they come out of.
Yeah. To go ahead and talk a little bit about the systems theory, because it's really important. You know, we don't emphasize that heavily in clinical psychology, but maybe we should a little bit more. But talk about scenarios where maybe the systems paradigm isn't considered and how that backfires, and then areas where it is considered and how it really works.
It's, in my experience, it's really not considered in the mental health profession. I mean, for instance, I bill insurance and I can't bill under a family name. I have to bill under an individual. So if a couple comes in to see me and they want to bill their insurance, I need to educate them. Well, first of all, I need to do an assessment and I need to see if, you know, if there's a diagnosis that one of you may be coming in here with, such as depression or situational depression or adjustment disorder or anxiety, whatever it is. I need to make those assessments. And then I have to bill under one of those people. Insurance is not going to cover marital counseling. They will cover family counseling, but again, there has to be an identified client.
Right.
So it's either a child or a teenager or a spouse or somebody. And then you can include the family, but most therapists that aren't trained systemically usually don't, or if they do, they do just a session or here or there to kind of see what's going on within the family system, but they're not really treating the family system. So of course, you know, I'm biased because I am a family therapist and I think that's severely lacking. I think that even if one person is diagnosable, it affects the entire system. If you're living with somebody who's depressed or who has diabetes or who has any type of medical or chronic issue, it's going to affect the entire family. And then everybody else starts dancing around that issue and having issues of their own because of those issues. So,
go ahead.
No, I love seeing the entire family. I always tell couples, even when they say, well, I want to come in individually, I usually ask the spouse to at least come to the first session because I
Right.
want to hear the whole story.
Sure. Talk about, are you familiar or do you remember some of the classic stories about when an individual got treated, how it ended up not really solving the overall problem when the system's point of view wasn't taken into consideration? Do you remember any of those at all? Just
Well, there's a lot of research showing that people who have marital issues, specifically marital issues, and go in for individual therapy, there's a much higher rate of divorce because they're going in, to talk about their individual issues. It's very individualized, the process, and they're not really taking the other person into consideration. And so then the road to divorce, I think, is easier. The other thing I remember quite a bit is kids who are like adolescents who get sent off to these kind of, I don't know, schools or kind of inpatient type of places, kids who are really kind of out of control. And so
Right.
they go away for a month or whatever, and they go and they do great work, in these places, and they really kind of get turned around, but then they get shipped right back to
Yes,
the original system.
exactly.
And so then all that kind of, it goes to waste. Now, a lot of those treatment centers are now trying to incorporate more family therapy, but it's very difficult when you have the family living, in Arizona and the treatment centers in Utah, or to really do true family therapy.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly what I was talking about. Unless you can treat someone in the context, sometimes the antecedents and the consequences of their behavior in the context of their living condition can be such strong reinforcers that if you're treating them without those things present, you're really not treating them.
Right.
Yeah. That's the behaviorist in me coming out.
Yeah. Now I have some behaviorism in me too, so I get that.
Okay, well, cool. So you got your master's, you did some work in addiction, and then talk about your early career and then how you started catering more and more towards Mormons.
Right. So this first job I had was in this, addictions treatment center. So I think I ran across one LDS person in that entire 2 years' time just by a fluke as far as a patient. But then after that, like I said, I had my first child, and so I really kind of, way slowed down, and we moved again, and we were living in Wisconsin. And I got in touch with LDS Family Services, and they hired me as a contract therapist. So LDS Family Services actually wasn't even in Wisconsin. The closest office was in Chicago. So I think they were happy that they would have a Mormon therapist up in the Milwaukee area. So I just kind of saw clients through them. They would refer me clients, and I would do that a few hours a week.
Right.
And then I kind of just went on my own after that. I just started my individual practice and
Okay.
started SPIT because I'm Mormon. Obviously, Mormon people know about me. LDS people, the wards, my bishop or my stake president would find out about me. And so that would be kind of a natural referral base. And so ever since then, I've been working majorly, I would say 90%, with LDS families and couples and individuals.
You wouldn't think that I guess you wouldn't think that your city or your regional area would supply enough LDS people to keep a therapist or part-time therapist fully occupied.
Well, for instance, when I was in, that's very interesting. I believe that a ward should be able to keep a therapist busy.
Right, 200 people?
Now, yes.
Yeah.
Well, and that's not even counting all the inactive people, right? So,
That's right.
I'm always surprised that, I'm working in a, usually I've worked in a 2 to 3 stake area, being the only LDS therapist, or maybe one of two, and that I'm not actually swamped. I'm always surprised that I'm not swamped.
I read a statistic today that at any given point in time, one out of every four adults qualifies for at least one full-blown official diagnosis out of the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual.
Sure.
Have you heard that type of
Sure.
statistic as well? So if you pick any four adults, one of them has either addiction or depression or anxiety or an eating disorder or some other type of major DSM disorder.
Right. Well, and it's interesting that you bring up the DSM because the DSM-4 also varies quite a bit in severity. I mean, there are some very serious disorders in there. I mean, from schizophrenia to bipolar to manic depression, whatever. But you do have also some very more kind of normal disorders, such as adjustment disorder.
Right.
You know, so in other words, something has happened in your life. You've moved or somebody has died or something kind of, you know, stressful and difficult has happened, and you can develop, you know, signs of depression or anxiety that are directly related to that, whatever it is you're adjusting to. So that's kind of more of a minimal disorder. It's still diagnosable. Many people have, I mean, it's probably the most common diagnosis given out is an adjustment disorder. And yeah, many people have those issues. That's kind of just part of normal life, but it's still diagnosable through the DSM-4. I think when we bring up the DSM-4, people get kind of freaked out, like, oh no, I'm in the DSM-4, I'm a freak. But you know, all of these things are very part of human life, and we all deal with them at some level or another.
And just tell our listeners really briefly what the DSM-4 is like and how it's structured.
The DSM-4 is, what is it? The Diagnostic Statistics Manual. And it's the fourth edition.
Right.
The fifth one is coming out, I think, shortly, within a year or two. It takes about 10 or 15 years for them to revise these things.
Yeah.
And it basically just walks through every single mental health diagnosis that we currently are aware of and have done research on and, you know, is statistically validated.
Right.
And it has all these criteria. So in other words, if you want to diagnose somebody with depression, there's usually a criteria for time. So in other words, how long has this person been having these symptoms? And then it has a whole list of symptoms. And it will say something like you have to have at least 4 of the 8 symptoms for at least 2 weeks or something along those lines.
Or
and
six
it varies.
Months,
you know, yeah. And it varies, you know, and each diagnosis is different. And it ranges from personality disorders to psychosis to just adjustment disorders to even, you know, developmental disorders like autism and learning disorders. I mean, it's all kind of just in there.
Right. And explain the concept of comorbidity real quick, if you will.
Comorbidity is when you have more than one diagnosis at the time. So in other words, it's easy to say, okay, well, I'm going to diagnose this person with depression because they're having all of these issues that they actually do qualify for. But if I don't think about, well, is this also, like, if I don't ask about, you know, are you drinking alcohol, for instance, if I don't ask that question, I'm missing out on possibly a whole different diagnosis. Because a lot of people who drink alcohol or who are addicted to alcohol can also show similar signs to being depressed.
Right.
So I can diagnose them as being depressed, but really that's an incorrect diagnosis because I haven't asked about their alcohol addiction. So you have to be very careful about making sure you're taking a very good assessment interview about all their different aspects of their life.
So do you do a pretty comprehensive assessment when you bring someone in for the first time?
I try to.
Do you use the SCID or what do you use?
I just I basically just do a verbal interview. I don't actually use
a structured
interview. Yeah, okay. I just have questions. I do have like an individual concern sheet that kind of has a bunch of symptoms that people can check off if they have or not. That kind of can lead me down certain paths.
Gotcha. Okay. So let's loop back a bit. You were talking about how you think that each LDS ward with, let's say, 250 active members. Could probably justify its own therapist full time, support a therapist full time. Were you implying that maybe there's a bit of a stigma, or that LDS church members are hesitant to use therapists, or too cheap, or don't want to? Was there some implication or speculation there, or experience there?
Yeah, I think that I mean, our culture overall is not super therapy friendly. I mean, just even American culture. So even out of the Mormon church. Now that has changed dramatically in the last 40 years or so. You know, people are much more comfortable seeing a therapist or getting mental health help in the last 20 to 40 years. There's been a huge difference in that. I would say that we as a church, as LDS members, are probably lagging a little bit in that. I think, and not just Mormons. I would, you know, I live in a very Christian conservative community right now, and I would say Christian conservatives in general, because I believe that people really rely on their spiritual lifestyle to help them with these problems, which is great. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, prayer and fasting and going to church and all these things that we do as part of our lifestyle do help us lead happier, better lives for the most part. But they're always not the full equation. They're not usually the only thing that can help us or the only thing that should be helping us. And so then, I do think that people are like, well, I should, you know, just be able to pray about this, and if I read my scriptures more, if I'm a better member, then this will go away. And when it doesn't go away, then you start falling into the problems of inert shame, that there must be something wrong with me. If my faith was strong enough, if I was doing things better, it would go away. And therein lies, I think, a huge problem within traditional religion.
So why is that not, and this is going to sound naive to a lot of people, but why is that naive or improper to think that if you live the gospel fully, you're not going to have mental illness? It may seem obvious, but I'm going to just ask the obvious question.
Right. No. Well, and I think, I mean, there's a little bit of play on words there. I mean, when we live the gospel fully, to me, that means that we're perfectly living the gospel. And if we're perfect, we probably wouldn't have mental problems. So there's probably some truth to that. And I hope that we can all, in some other life, experience that. And therein lies the problem, that we're not living the gospel perfectly. We may be very good members, and we may be not, you know, going out doing horrific sins, but we're all struggling in our day-to-day life, and we all struggle with our thoughts and our attitudes and, you know, kids and just all kinds of struggles. This is part of this mortal life. And so we're not going to be able to live the gospel completely perfectly at this time of our lives. And so I think all those tools that we're given by the church to help us do help us, but they're not always the complete equation.
Right.
And this goes back to also people not completely understanding or not looking at it in that mental health is actually very similar to physical health, but we don't always correlate those two. That, you know, if somebody goes in and breaks their bone, if your kid breaks their bone, you know, by falling out of the tree, you're usually not going to hold a neighborhood fast and sit around and wait for that bone to heal. You're going to rush him to the emergency room and get an x-ray done and get proper treatment. And because we live in a time when we have that available to us. Now, they didn't always have that available. You know, people didn't always have x-rays and maybe back in time, there were times when all they could do was pray about it and try to ask for help and healing, because that's all they had. That's all they had as part of the resources. So I think we need to make that jump with mental health, that we have so many resources available to us, from therapy to medicine to, I mean, there's, you know, 50 different types of therapies out there that are all very useful in their own right. And many times we're not using these resources because we think we should just be able to only rely on our spiritual resources. And I think that's just kind of a shame. I think it's changing over time, but I wish it would just be a little faster so we wouldn't have to suffer in silence or suffer with pain that we really otherwise maybe wouldn't need to suffer with.
Why do you think there's been some hesitance or reluctance in addition to just exclusively relying on the gospel teachings? In your experience, are there any other reasons why LDS people have sometimes been hesitant to seek out a therapist?
Well, I think one of the main reasons is, are we going to see a therapist who's not LDS and therefore who's not going to espouse correct ideas, or tell us to do things that we're not in agreement with or not understand where we're coming from? And there's some validity to that, although I always say that, a well-trained ethical therapist, regardless of religion or race or anything, should be able to respect the traditional values and religious context that a couple, family, or individual comes in with. I mean, I have seen many people from different religions, and it's not my job to tell them they're incorrect or that that shouldn't be a part of their life. My job is to use that as a resource for them in their life.
Right.
So, but there are certain things that in our culture, kind of sometimes I could see some therapists maybe thinking was unhealthy, like our focus on not masturbating or premarital sex or things like that, where maybe some therapists
Or homosexuality, or stance
or
on homosexuality.
homosexuality, exactly, or even mixed faith marriages, or when one person loses a faith and not maybe a therapist would have a hard time understanding the depth of that for the other spouse. Not that they would minimize it, but they might just not understand the full depth of what that means.
And I guess there's also the I don't know, it feels like at times some church leaders have been a little bit critical of the mental health profession maybe in the past.
Yes, I haven't completely. I don't remember that. Maybe I'm young enough
No, I think
still, but
I should have the quote with me, but I think in Mormon Doctrine, Bruce R. McConkie called
sure.
psychiatry like a tool of the devil or something to that
Sure.
effect.
Yeah, and there have it. I mean, those are difficult comments because taken in the cultural context, they make sense. They don't make a lot of sense today. So, you can kind of understand how 50 years ago a church leader would say something like that, whereas, no church leader would say something like that today. So that, therein lies a whole nother struggle of where do we draw the line as to what we take to heart as far as what church leaders say. I mean, that's always a something that as members we always have to deal with. But my experience has been that in almost every general conference I've listened to here recently, they will mention something along the lines of if you need professional help, please feel, like you have the right and the opportunity to do that. And we have LDS Family Services who hires therapists who are hired by the church. So obviously they did no longer have those stances.
Okay, that's great. That's a great intro. Thank you, for that. Let's go ahead and move to, let's just say we were going to cover four or five of the biggest issues that you see in your practice that are facing either LDS church members or Mormons defined more broadly, active or inactive. Let's just go ahead and start talking about some of the biggest ones you see and what you think. The culture or the faith may or may not contribute to that, if it's normal, if it's consistent across all religions, or if it's something in some way unique or peculiar to Mormonism, and then a little bit about how you've helped people work through that. And feel free to use as many stories as you feel is appropriate, of course, protecting people's anonymity. Any stories you can provide to help, give context and color would be great.
Sure. Well, I guess, gosh,
It's a big question.
do we have 5 hours? So I guess there's a lot of I hate to put them in a list like of importance because any issue that anybody's facing is important. As far as themes that, seem to come up over and over, I mean, probably the number one would have to do with sexuality. And when I say sexuality, I mean, there's like 20 different topics we could talk about from, children that are touching themselves and parents freak out and don't know what to do and start shaming their kids, from a very young age to, you know, the pressure that we put on our teens to not have premarital sex, and to not masturbate and to basically have nothing to do with their sexual selves, to just kind of ignore that whole aspect of themselves, to then they get married and either they're dealing with guilt because they did have premarital experience, and maybe lied about it to get into the temple because that was the cultural pressure to do. They couldn't face their parents and say, you know, I'm not worthy to get married in the temple. To then, or maybe they really, you know, they waited and they did everything right and they did control their sexual urges and now they're married and they can't turn them back on. So now what do we do? Like, I'm not enjoying sex, not having fun with this. I don't even, I feel dirty. I don't like this part of my life because I've been trying to avoid it for so long. To then just more normal things, which are, you know, you have children and the hormones that come along with that and the stress that comes along with parenting and how that affects our sexuality.
Right.
To then, I think, you know, the ideas of, you know, our sex only is it's only meant to have children. So, you know, I don't really particularly want to have sex with you unless we're trying to have kids. You know, those kinds of issues that couples have that somehow there's something wrong or innately dirty or bad about sex. Then we haven't even talked about singles who don't get married and are expected to be celibate till, you know, there's people in our church who are single in their 30s and 40s or have never been able to explore that aspect of their lives and are expected not to.
Right.
Or people who have lost a spouse and, you know, so have had a great sexual life and then all of a sudden they have no sexual life and how to make that transition because they're not supposed to, you know, do anything.
Right.
And then of course there's the whole homosexuality realm and that's a huge aspect that we could speak about, that really affects many members of our church and the expectations that are placed on them. And most of the people that I've worked in that realm have desperately tried to follow all the rules, have gone on their missions, have married in the temple, and I think at some level expected this problem to go away. You know, if they did everything right, then it should just, you know, problems go away when you do good things and you're blessed and they go away and they don't. And so then they're with three or four kids and coming out to their spouses and it's kind of a huge disaster for them and for their spouses and for their families.
Right.
So there's a lot of
wide range.
Yeah. Wide range of sexuality issues.
Well, let me just try and tease a couple of those out and just have a quick talk about a couple of those. I guess we're going to be delving in depth on these topics, over the coming weeks and months. And so I would like to invite listeners now and in all the topics that Natasha and I discuss to write us if, you know, if they have experience or some type of story to share about these types of issues. We won't be doing therapy on the air at all. We're not interested in that. That's not really ethical or possible, but we do want to find people who are interested in telling their stories and most importantly, how they were able to work through and find some type of greater happiness or health as a result. So this is going to be a framing, one of the many framings for hopefully many future episodes. But I guess I'm interested in teasing out just a few of the items that you mentioned that might be a little bit more unique to Mormonism than maybe other places. And I want to begin just with masturbation. Have you been able to find out from church leaders whether masturbation is officially prohibited or not, or allowed or verboten, or what the status is with masturbation in the church?
I am still on a quest, John, for information.
Have
on
you
this.
Tried? Have you
I
tried?
I have tried, and I've gotten a lot of different responses. That's what's difficult. There doesn't seem to be one classic thing. I know that there's a bishop's handbook out there, but only bishops get to look at them.
Right.
And I know it does mention some things in there that were read to me at one point. I didn't memorize it. I don't think the actual word masturbation was used.
Mm-hmm.
but there might have been something along the lines of anything degrading or self
Is it self-abuse?
abuse or hurting or these words that are very kind of vague
Right.
and that can be interpreted completely different by many people. I mean, this is oral sex, for instance, comes into play here. You know, is oral sex okay or not? Well, if you think oral sex is demeaning, well, then it falls under that. And many people don't find it demeaning. And so then they think it's fine. So, and then you have the issues where one spouse thinks it's fine and one spouse doesn't. And there aren't, I think, really, the church hasn't put out really a list of, you know, this is okay and this is not okay. I think they just kind of have these vague things. Now, once you're married, it's a little easier because they do say something along the lines that, you know, as long as both are comfortable and both people are not feeling coerced into doing something, then it's up to the couple. So the couple kind of has a lot of leeway, you know, to kind of figure out their own sex life, which I think is wonderful. I think it's very healthy. And I think that's what couples should be doing, is exploring their sexuality together instead of with their bishop.
Right.
So,
but there, to make it even more confusing, as I understand it, there was a letter released by the church at some point in the early 80s that actually stated that oral sex was not to be engaged in, and it was retracted, I think, within the year. This is all my foggy memory, but have you heard something to that effect?
Yes, I heard about that. It was on my blog for quite a bit. A lot of different people wrote in about that, and a lot of people are pretty knowledgeable about what exactly happened. I think what my understanding of it was that it was a letter directed towards bishops or stake presidents. It wasn't really a letter directed to the general public.
Okay.
Kind of as a guidance, you know, to them. And then, yeah, very quickly it was retracted. And so it was never an official statement that was given out like to the entire church.
But something like that can really penetrate the consciousness of the culture.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely. And you can see that 40 years later, we're still, you know, or 30 years later, we're still
grappling with it.
Yeah.
Do you have a position on masturbation as a therapist, or are you able to have one, or?
Well, I'm trying to develop my position on masturbation. My position on masturbation, and a lot of this has to do, believe it or not, with Elder Packer, who usually tends to be pretty conservative.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote something, I believe, fairly recently, or it was a talk and probably a priesthood session, I'm assuming, to the young men about understanding. And I wish I had this in front of me, but I believe that he stated that masturbation was a transgression and not a sin, something along those lines. And that, you know, try to control yourselves kind of idea, but that this isn't the worst thing ever that you could do.
Right.
Something along those lines. It was only about two sentences long or three.
Okay.
But that kind of helped me understand. I mean, masturbation is something that we are doing in the womb, believe it or not, now that we can look at our – well, okay, well, first of all, let's define masturbation.
Okay.
Because I do think that there's a difference between masturbation and self-stimulation. Self-stimulation to me is you're touching your genitals.
Mm-hmm.
And all kids do this. And that's what I mean by you're doing it in the womb.
Right.
All kids touch their genital areas at one point or another. Boys often more than girls because it's just more readily available, but
right.
Girls do it too. I believe that when you start getting, you know, more closer to puberty and you start maybe having more ability to fantasize or have more ideas of falling in love or erotic thoughts, I mean, those can still happen at a fairly young age. I mean, I remember at age 6 watching Cinderella thinking this prince was the most amazing thing ever. So, I mean, there was definitely some type of, I don't know if erotic is the right word, but there was that idea that that's what you do is you fall in love. And so we have that from a very young age. But I think at puberty or a little bit before puberty, so maybe starting around age 10 or 11, thoughts can take more of an eroticized
right.
state. And then kids can start to masturbate to the point, you know, of orgasm or ejaculation or things like that more readily than they can when they're kids.
Right. Okay.
So, and then of course, you know, adults can too. So I think my position on masturbation is it's a great tool to teach our kids about their sexuality, but it's not something that we should be shaming our kids about.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, when sometimes parents pick up on the fact that their kids are masturbating or they want to talk to their kids about masturbation, I think it's a great tool to start talking about, you know, your body does have some natural urges. Your body will respond to touch. It's supposed to do that. That there's nothing wrong with you, that this happens. It happens to everybody. And then start talking more about what sexuality is about and how it's meant to be with, you know, a special partner that you choose someday and, you know, blah, de, blah, de, blah. And I think these conversations need to begin no sooner than young men and young women. So in other words, if you find your kids masturbating before then, ignore it.
Mm-hmm.
But after, you know, they're more of an age of accountability, I guess, you know, 12, 13, 14, mm-hmm. those are the times when you start talking about self-control and, you know, what the purpose of sexuality is, but in a non-shaming, non-detrimental way.
Yeah, because a lot of parents
and still realizing that they're probably still going to do it. I mean, the statistics are that men, I mean, we're at like 99% of men do this, and yet I get people all the time that come into my office claiming that they've never done this.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, okay. And women are, I think, at anywhere between 60 and 75%. The numbers there are more hazy because I think women just don't want to admit to it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay.
And those are not Mormon statistics. Those are kind of general statistics.
And do you have any stories of where the shaming or the stigma or the fear, maybe about missions or whatever, led to some pretty sad or unhealthy results?
Well, one thing that I'm noticing, the more clients I have regarding pornography addiction, which is one thing we didn't mention before, but that's coming up more and more now with, I think, you know, the internet becoming so readily available to everybody. And when I go back into their histories and start asking them, you know, so when did you, you know, start masturbating, or when did you figure out your body was sexual or things? Most of those men, I'm going to focus on men here, will start telling me, yeah, you know, I started having wet dreams, or I started, you know, thinking, hey, this was fun or this felt good, you know, probably somewhere around the age of 12 to 13. And right around the time that they're getting their first priesthoods, you know, so they're becoming deacons and such, and they're having their first interviews. And usually not completely understanding what some of the words the bishops are using even mean.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times kids who are 12 or 13, a lot of them know, because in this day and age, kids are getting great sexual education at school. And I don't mean that fishy. I mean, a lot of them are getting great sexual education at school through the school, but they're also getting a whole nother sexual education from their friends.
Right.
And which is usually pretty graphic and pretty, you know, where they use a lot of the slang words and things like that.
Right.
So by the time that kids hit puberty, they definitely have some idea of their sexuality, but it's usually in very different language than the bishop who's asking them, well, you know, do you masturbate or do you, you know, right. touch yourself or whatever. And it can be very intimidating for a 12 or 13 year old to even admit to those things, or to even completely understand, am I doing that or am I not? Or, you know,
right.
So therein starts, you know, the interviews, and therein starts the lies. And this is not true research. This is just my experience has been that it's a very similar story, that the lying begins very early on in these priesthood interviews, because there's no way that they're going to tell their dad's friend or whoever the bishop is that they're, you know, that they're doing this. It's right. very personal, very private, very embarrassing for a young kid to talk about this kind of stuff.
And a Mormon father won't sit down with the son and say, yep, I masturbated, because there's this feeling like I may have done it, but I don't want my son to do it. And I don't want to encourage him or give him the idea. And so the son's going to think that he's the only one,
Right.
even though, as you mentioned, 90 to 99% of all the fathers are either doing it or have done it.
Right.
And that's, there's this weird inability to be candid and honest with the son for fear. But what do you think about that? If a father said to you, well, I don't want to give my son the idea, I don't want to make him think about it, and I also don't want to encourage him to do it if he otherwise wouldn't, and so I don't want to talk to him about it because, you know, I don't want to make it happen more or increase the frequency or make him think it's justifiable because I did it. But I think most conscientious Mormon men would feel that way.
Yeah, I think you bring up a good point, although I do know men that are very candid about this with their kids. And I do think that that is the healthier approach, to be open and honest and candid with our kids. This question is a little far reach. I mean, a lot of people will say the same thing about premarital sex. Well, do
right.
I have to tell my kids, you know, that I had premarital sex and that, you know, I really regretted it so that then they know that I did that. And I think that there is a level of privacy that a parent can and should have. I don't think that we need to tell our kids every single mistake that we've made, or I don't think that that's necessarily appropriate or necessary to be a good teacher. You can say things like, you know, I had similar struggles, you know, I went through similar things, my body responded in similar ways. Everybody's does. So you can have kind of a normalizing approach without necessarily having to spill every single bean of your whole life to your kids. But kids are very astute, very bright, and they pick up on things very easily. So if there's a sense of shame or the idea that we're not talking about it, therefore it won't happen, is very problematic.
Right, right.
Because communication actually is what, like 80% nonverbal?
Right.
Something like that?
That's right. Yeah.
So if we have a sense of shame about sex in our homes, kids will pick up on that.
Yeah. Okay. So you said the lying starts early. Do you see a pattern as it progresses? Were you going to take us through some type of pattern beyond the early lying?
Well, I think the pattern that progresses, which gets more and more serious in severity, is that, you know, they begin to lie now to go on their missions. And then they lie to go to the temple. And by this time, they're so shame-based that it's just kind of part of that whole cycle of shame. And when people are shame-based, in other words, they feel so ashamed of themselves, the number one tool that maybe, if you want to call it the adversary or whatever, uses is that there's no hope. There's no ability to progress or to start over. Like, I'm already going to hell, so why even try? Or I can't, this is not something I'm going to be able to recover from. And those kinds of thoughts and ideas are very powerful and can ruin an entire life.
Right, right.
Now, not everybody that, I'm not going to say that shame or that the idea that we tell our kids not to masturbate is the only reason why people become pornography addicts. There's plenty of people who grew up in shame-based homes who are not addicts. So there are other proponents that, you know, a lot of people have tendencies to become addicted to things. That's kind of more personality traits. But it's usually if you combine two or three major things that kind of put together this little boiling stew that can kind of tend to go towards those ways.
Gotcha. So just real quick, do you know what the status is about masturbation and missions? Are you seeing people not going on missions because of masturbation or coming home because of it or coming home from the MTC? Are you seeing any of that?
I wouldn't say specifically because of masturbation. Well, I guess that the church has some type of 6-month, this is all hearsay, so I'll just put that out there. But something about that usually the boys are asked to abstain from masturbating for at least 6 months before they're given the okay to go on a mission. Whether or not every, you know, stake president or bishop holds them to that accountability, I have no idea. I have heard of some that have been held to that. And whether or not, you know, our elders are getting sent home from their missions for that, I highly doubt it, because I've heard of a lot of other issues that are going on out in the mission fields that even then they're not getting sent home. So maybe there's been a case or two out there. I'm sure there have been. And maybe when it becomes excessive, I mean, like, for instance, if you're addicted to masturbation and you're masturbating like 5 times a day or something along those lines, maybe, you know, if they can't get that in control, if they can't go out with their partner because they've got to stay home and masturbate, well, right. Maybe they do get sent home for those kinds of issues.
Okay.
But as far as, you know, I masturbated 2 or 3 times on my mission and I got sent home, I've never heard of that.
Okay. Okay. Right. Okay. We talked a little bit about some of the different areas in sexuality that can affect adults. Just generally, if you had just a few of the most common of those to dig a little bit deeper, you know, couples especially, what are some of the things you're seeing most with couples as they struggle with sexuality, and maybe a few high-level pointers that you often give marriage couples when they're struggling with sex?
Well, probably with couples, the number one issue that comes up is libido differences. So in other words, one of them has a higher sex drive than the other, and therefore now they're not compatible in their sexuality together. Now, this is normal. Nobody has a perfectly synchronized sex drive with your partner, but it can become excessive, you know, when you've gone several months without being, you know, having sex, or when it always feels like the one partner's initiating and the other partner's always like, oh, well, okay. Even if they do it, it's kind of that, well, if I have to kind of thing. So it's not very intimacy producing.
Is there a minimum frequency that you recommend to your clients?
No, not necessarily. I think that that's very highly personalized. But I think that, you know, if you want to do the bell curve kind of thing, most couples that are satisfied, if I'm doing quotation marks,
sure.
You can't really see me do
air quotes.
Normal, right? All those words.
Right.
They fall somewhere between 1 to 3 times a week. You know, that's kind of the bell curve in the normal range. There are couples that can have sex once a month and be perfectly happy with that because they both feel fine with that. And there are couples that want to have sex 5 times a week and love that and feel great about that. The problem comes when you have the person who wants to have sex once a month married to the person who wants to have it 5 times a week or, you know, something like that. And it doesn't even have to be that drastic of a difference to have some significant issues.
Right.
So that, and I guess how that relates to our religion, I think goes back to this idea, and I do see this, I'm talking in stereotypes, and I kind of hate that, but this issue is more to do with women having the lower libido than men.
Right.
That's not always the case, but that tends to be more common anyway. And I think it's Laura Brotherson who wrote And They Were Not Ashamed or something like that. The link is on my blog if people want to look it up. But it talks about this idea of good girl syndrome. And this kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier about, you know, we teach our kids to kind of shut off their sexuality. And women in general are, I think, maybe even given a higher, I mean, the girls are the ones that can get pregnant. So I think in culture in general, girls are treated differently sexually than boys. There's some kind of inherent sexism that happens. And so girls are very much taught to kind of shut that hole off. Don't dress immodestly. Don't attract attention to yourself sexually. Do not have sex. Do not think sex. Do not, when you go out on a date, don't let him touch you.
Dress modestly.
I've heard of a lot of Mormons who even say, don't kiss him until you're married.
Right.
I don't agree with that. So things like that, you know, that just very much shut off that part of your life until you're married. And then these girls, there's a lot of messages there that are kind of shame-based again, that this is a bad thing, that this is not good, that you shouldn't do this. And then they're supposed to just switch it all back on.
Right.
You know, in just one day when they get married. And I think a lot of women have a hard time with that. Women are much more psychological in their sexuality than men are to begin with. I mean, we need to be in the mood anyway. And there's a lot of other things going on with women, but I think when you combine this particular issue with it, it can really make sex a negative aspect of their lives.
Right.
And they'll have sex. They understand that their men, that their husband want, you know, needs that or wants that. And so they're willing to do it, but they're not really that engaged in it. They don't enjoy it. And therefore the sexual relationship lacks, you know, a lot of excitement and intimacy, which is what it's supposed to be all about.
Sure. And how do you start to help people work through that?
No, I guess probably education is the number one thing, is kind of normalizing that this is why this has happened, and exploring their backgrounds, having them tell me, you know, what were the messages that you received about sex? What would be the ideal for you? You know, if you kind of visualizing a future that's different, like if you had no issues, what would that look like? And then actually having them do exercises that, you know, there's the sunset focus that I have a lot of my couples do, and which is basically like mutual massage, and there's all different levels. So you can do it clothed, you can do it unclothed, you know, kind of just building up the comfort level. I think couples a lot of times just really appreciate the education, just understanding that they're not weird, that this isn't, that they're not alone in this, that there's a lot of biological issues going along with this as well, you know, right, hormonal things. And so that they can feel like, gosh, it's not just that I'm just really a bad person, or that I have, you know, I'm dysfunctional somehow.
Right.
There are some dysfunctions with sexuality that can happen, you know, like women who can't ever reach orgasm, or vaginismus, where it actually hurts to, when they're penetrated, or, you know, suction hurt. So there are some things that can be biological in nature that are going on, or that the psychology can be also adding to that.
And some husbands can be pretty insensitive, I guess, to satisfying their wives. Is that?
I think that there can be insensitivity on both parts.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes. And I have seen great sensitivity on both parts, and really great willingness to really work together and try to figure something out. So I think the insensitivity comes from feeling hurt, feeling unwanted, you know, feeling like, you know, gosh, every time I approach you, you roll your eyes and you're like, ugh, again.
Right.
That's kind of painful.
And probably understanding the love language of the other is an important part of setting a stage for proper intimacy, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, I don't know how many people know what a love language is, but there's a book called Love Languages. I think it's Gary Chapman who wrote that. And kind of this idea that we think other people think like we do.
Right.
We're kind of all egocentric in that way.
Yeah, right, yeah.
So if I like to be touched, you must like to be touched, you know. Mm-hmm. When you don't like to be touched, then that must mean you don't like me, because, you know, I like to be touched. So instead of thinking, well, maybe you just don't like to be touched, maybe you like me to, you know, wash the dishes instead, or bring you flowers, or, you know, help with the kids, or... I mean, there's all kinds of, I guess those were all kind of male things, so I'm being sexist too here. But there's definitely, you know, I think even, you know, women who don't like to be touched don't recognize that that's a love language sometimes of their husbands. And until they're willing to give what the person needs instead of just willing to give what I would like to receive.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Sure, sure. I have to admit, I do have the impression that, I guess I have the expectation that 90% of the people you'd see would be couples in their 20s and 30s or 40s, where the husband wants it more than the wife, and or the husband isn't really doing what he needs to make it pleasurable, or to make the setting and the environment comfortable for the wife. Is that an unfair sort of generalization that, you know, it's at that level, and then that's the most common scenario by a large number? Or is it much
Well,
more?
and maybe this is my systems coming out, but I am very wary of blaming one person over the other. I think women need to take responsibility for their sex lives just as much as men need to take responsibility for it. So I think it's unfair when we as women say, well, he's just not nice and he didn't help me with the dishes. And so therefore, now he just wants to have sex even though I'm, tired. And I mean, there's some truth to that. And the man does have to understand that that usually doesn't work. So if he wants success in the future, that's not a good path to follow. But I don't think that we can just sit back and go, well, he's just not a good enough husband, so I'm not willing to do this, in our marriage. I don't think that's healthy. So I really try to look at what how they're both communicating and acting, in their marriages so that they can both take responsibility for something. Even if the husband is a real jerk. Is she enabling that? So, so do you see what I'm saying? There's something, why are you with a big jerk then? Like what was it so attractive about being with a big jerk? So in other words, how can she stand up for herself more and say, hey, this isn't appropriate, or I'm not going to stand for this. And I love you, but this isn't going to work. So that he can have clear boundaries or, or things like that. Those are, we're kind of getting more into now. Abusive relationships, which can be emotionally abusive. But it can also be just as abusive to, shut down and just say, well, you're not allowed to touch me, and I don't care if you have that need. So, the whole idea of, well, I'll give you what you need if you give me what you need, or I need it, that doesn't usually work. First of all, we have to kind of meet our own needs a lot of times. And then be willing to meet somebody else's needs. I mean, all the interesting conundrums in marriage always fascinate me as far as what Heavenly Father's really trying to teach us through this process.
Sure, it's a great laboratory, isn't it?
Being connected with this total other individual and how that works. So it's fascinating, and it can be a great challenge and journey for those of us who choose to see it that way.
Yeah. Well, again, this is just going to be a high-level view, and I hope to get into all these topics a lot more in depth in coming episodes.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. To comment on this episode or to provide feedback, please check us out at mormonstories.org. If you want to help keep Mormon Stories alive, please consider either making a financial contribution or spreading the word about this episode through your blog, Twitter account, Facebook page, family newsletter, or through your ward bulletin and ward newsletter. Just kidding about those last two. Music on this episode was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton. Check them out at claytonpixton.com or skypixton.com. That's Sky with an E, Skye, Pixton.com. Thank you.